Okay, don't take any more calls. For that guy I interrupted earlier, where did Jeremiah build and plant? Answer, Ireland. 5 years after he disappears from the biblical record, he shows up in Ireland with the daughter of Zedekiah, Tiatephi, that he gave in marriage to the High King of Ireland. He brought with him several things, and he exacted from the king certain conditions for giving Tiatephi in marriage to the High King of Ireland. One, Tara would become the center of the kingdom. You know the Hebrew has no vowels written. In later years, passed on orally, they have what they call vowel points. But the oldest manuscripts have no vowels written at all. In fact, at the cathedral in the Bible collection, we have the very first Hebrew Bible that was ever printed with vowel points. So take the vowels away. Tara and Torah are the same. It passes into English the way it sounds, because verbally they use vowels. But in the Hebrew, Torah and Tara spell the same. Not only did it become the center of the kingdom, Ireland's the only place in the world where all the citizens were required to come 3 times a year, not 4 and not 2, 3 times a year. They called them fairs. In Palestine, they called them feasts. Those are the only 2 places. 3 times a year, all the citizens of ancient Israel had to go to the spiritual center of the nation, ultimately Jerusalem. Passover time, Feast of Pentecost, and that combination of fall feasts, the spring Passover time was a combination of 3 feasts. Passover, first fruits, a Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits. Second time was that feast 50 days after Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, or harvest. And the third time was the cluster of feasts in the fall, Feast of the Trumpets, Atonement, and Tabernacles. Ireland's the only other country where they had 3 great fairs, as they called them, and all the citizens were required to come to what became the spiritual center of the nation, Tara, which just as easily could be Torah. He wrote the laws of Ireland. Those laws became the basis of the common law in England, and the basis for this nation formed with a social contract as a nation of law. The only place in the world that they point to a grave place of Jeremiah is Ireland. They got graves of all the great prophets and patriarchs all over Palestine. No grave for Jeremiah. The only place in the world that point to a grave for Jeremiah, Ireland. As the only place in the world they point to a grave for Mary and Martha and Lazarus, who died a second time, being the one who was raised from the dead. The only place they point to their graves is South France. The only place that a people point to Jeremiah's grave is Ireland. No nation in the world, as I said the other night, has as many boys and men named Jerry or Jeremy as in Ireland. And he brought things with him, including a rock, a stone, on which, at Tara, the High King of Ireland and subsequent kings stood when they were crowned. There's nothing gone wrong with the shortwave. I'm lighting this monstrous pipe. It takes a blowtorch to light it. It's so big. Have these for peace pipes. Once you light them, you smoke them so long, a generation dies before you can go to war. He brought a rock. The same rock on which we read through Kings and Chronicles, the kings of Israel and Judah were crowned upon. They stood on that pillar, or beside a pillar. This rock had special significance. It was claimed to be the rock, and I believe was, the rock on which Jacob laid his head the night he fled and slept, having deceived his father and his brother and stolen the birthright. And God gave him a vision of angels descending from heaven and gave him a promise. When he awakened the next morning, he did two things. He named the place where it happened, which is now in the area of the city of Nablus in northern Israel, between the mounts Ebal and Gerizim. He named the place Bethel. Beth meaning house, El meaning God, house of God. But he also anointed the rock on which he had rested his head and called the rock Bethel. Why did he anoint two things? Now later God accepted the name because he appeared to him later and said, I'm the God of Bethel. Now, these were people that were prone to keep relics. When the children of Israel were in the wilderness and the serpents came because of their sin and bit them, and they were dying, God told Moses to construct a brazen serpent, which was ultimately seen to be as a type of Christ, who took our sins on the cross. That's why the serpent. And Moses was said to construct this brazen serpent and put it on a pole and raise it. And all who looked at the serpent on the pole, brazen serpent, and brass is a symbol of judgment, and the serpent a symbol of sin, all who looked on it were forgiven spiritually, but also healed of their snake bite physical condition. That became the emblem of the medical profession for healing. It was a type of Christ as the sin bearer. God laid on him our sins, thus the serpent, and brazen, because brass was always the symbol of judgment. Years later, Hezekiah, a later king, discovered that they had not only kept the relic, they were worshiping it. Instead of keeping the relic as a point of contact to remind them of what God had done, they worship the relic. In that case, Hezekiah, because they were worshiping the relic, gave it a name that sounds real fancy in the King James, Nehushtan, but that's just a straight transliteration of the original word. Nehushtan means thing of brass. He named it a thing of brass. And he broke it in pieces because they had begun worshiping it instead of preserving it to remind them of what God had done. But it illustrates the way they preserved these religious relics. Well, do you really believe that Jacob would not preserve the rock that he had anointed and named House of God? That's why he anointed two things. He couldn't move the place with him. He could anoint the place, it'd always be there, and it came to be known as Bethel. But he anointed the rock on which he rested his head when the vision came, because he could take it with him. Now, I've already taught in this series that the Jew did not get the birthright. Again, I'm going to say, all Hebrews are not Jews. Hebrew simply means stranger, foreigner. Not all Hebrews are Jews, all Jews are Hebrews. Not all of Abraham's descendants are Jews. All Jews are Abraham's descendants. Not all descendants of Jacob are Jews. All Jews are descendants of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. His descendants were Israelites. Not all Israelites are Jews. All Jews are Israelites. The word Jew did not occur, I repeat, until the kingdom divided at the death of Solomon and Rehoboam formed the so-called kingdom of the ten tribes to the north. Rehoboam was of the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim was the dominant tribe, and the northern kingdom, called the House of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, sometimes Samaria after its capital city, but also called Ephraim or Ephraimites, because Ephraim was the dominant tribe, and when the birthright was divided, Judah got the scepter, right to rule, and the right to make the laws. Ephraim and the sons of Joseph got the birthright. The northern kingdom, dominated by Ephraim, represented the people to whom the birthright promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob of a vast multitude of people, possessing the gates of their enemies, never defeated in major war, a commonwealth of nations. Those promises went to the sons of Joseph. To Judah went the right to rule, be king, and make the laws. Unless you understand that out of 1 Chronicles 5 and Genesis 48 and 49, you'll never decipher the prophetic promises of God. And in the giving of the birthright to Joseph, there's an enigmatic phrase in Genesis 49. The promise to Joseph in verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough. Even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. A hint that these birthright people, the sons of Joseph, would overrun and run over the wall and leave Palestine. The arms of his hands were made strong, verse 24 says, by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And then to this Joseph group that received the birthright, this enigmatic parenthetical promise, from thence, or from Joseph, is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, the rock called the shepherd rock. There is no possibility, in my judgment, that Jacob would ever lose that pillar stone that he anointed as God's house, certainly more important as a religious relic than the brazen serpent. When he went down to Egypt, he took it with him. As he gives his blessing to his sons, he gives to Ephraim the custody of the shepherd stone. The shepherd, it was called. In the New Testament, Paul says they all followed and they all drank of that rock. And that rock was Jesus, our shepherd. I used to puzzle when I read at Rephidim. The people were told to go to Rephidim. Rephidim means place of rest. After they had crossed the Red Sea, went 3 days into the wilderness, complained because of thirst. God showed Moses the water and then felled a tree and sweetened the waters. Again, a type of Christ. All of this was. They were God's oracle. He was going to make them tell the story of what Christ was going to do, whether they understood it or not. He then said, go to Rephidim. Rephidim means place of rest. They got to Rephidim. It was rocks, cactus, dirt, heat, no water. And they began to murmur. 3.25 to 3.5 million people. That's a lot of people. And God says to Moses, command the people to stand before the rock. You want to figure out for a minute how difficult it would be to tell 3.25 million people which rock to stand by if nobody knows any particular rock of any significance. There's rocks all over the place. Stand by the rock. Can't you see them going every direction? And they're counting me down, but there don't need to be any identities at 10:30, half hour. I'm going to keep talking. 3.5 million. We only got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cameras in here. If I shouted to you, go stand by the camera. Which camera are you going to stand by? Now, some of you will stand by the camera in front of me because it's most prominent. But stand by the camera. That's all Moses said to 3.5 million people. God said, tell them, stand by the rock. It had to be a rock that had that significance, the rock. Why not? It's the house of God. It's the shepherd's stone. And he says, strike it. And water came out of that flinty rock as a type of Christ being stricken on the cross, and life-giving waters flowed out of it. I've often wondered about the pillar of cloud by day and the fire by night and the shepherd's stone. Was this rock that? Fire, just as God put fire on a bush and it didn't burn. In this case, he put real fire on a rock. And then fire out during the day and the moisture and steam go up. Did God use this rock in some spectacular way? I've often wondered about this pillar of cloud. It doesn't have to be this rock, but it's called the shepherd's stone. There's some speculation and wonder in it, and then there's fact. How do they go 40 years in the wilderness where there's no water? What kind of water truck did they have? They got thirsty at this occasion. God supplied water out of a flinty rock. They obviously didn't have water up till that point because they were 3 days into the wilderness and were complaining of thirst. They had no water. They had run out of water in 3 days. Whatever water they carried with them out of Egypt. And God provided water, but it was bitter. And then had Moses fell a tree and put it in the water as a type of Christ, and the water was sweetened. But then he said, leave. Now, however much water they ran out by the time they got to Rephidim, because they're thirsting again. What was their water supply for 40 years in the wilderness? They asked permission to go through one desert chieftain's territory, and they promise that they will not use any water as an expensive and rare commodity in the desert. You remember Lawrence of Arabia, how it opens? With that guy getting shot because he'd taken a bucket of water out of the well that didn't belong to him? Water's priceless. We have the illustration. They ran out of water in 3 days after they left the Red Sea. They ran out of water in a very short time by the time they got to Rephidim. Yet we find later on they're going through a desert chieftain's territory and Moses covenants with them. They won't touch any of his water. Now we've got to have a water supply for the cattle as well as the people and the animals. Use your head. This is a flesh and blood book. They got their food miraculously, manna fallen from heaven every day. Their shoes didn't wear out. Their sandals didn't wear out for 4 years. Another miracle that people sort of pass over. You say, you believe this? Hell yes, I believe it. I didn't until I settled the resurrection. If I can believe the resurrection, I believe this. Keeping shoe leather from wearing out is easier than raising somebody from the dead. And then if I believe that, I can believe God spoke and the universe was formed. If he spoke and nothing became everything, he can sure supply manna from heaven and keep sandals. The water's a big puzzle to me. I mean, we have God giving us the record of them running out of water in 3 days, I repeat, and then running out of water by the time they got to Rephidim and complaining. Then they travel 40 years. And they're so carrying their own water supply 40 years. I mean, they must have invented an awful big bucket at Rephidim. One they didn't have when they left the Red Sea because it only lasted 3 days. One they didn't have by the time they got to Rephidim because they'd run out again. But from Rephidim on, except for one other occasion, they not only have water, they have enough water they're carrying with them, they can march across a chieftain's territory and not let their cattle or themselves take any water. They carried the rock with them. It's the same rock from Rephidim. It was their continuous water supply. What'd God do? Feed 3.5 million on, and by noon, then they had a battle. Remember, the Amalekites came, and they fought. And when they got done fighting, Moses up on the hill, when his arms get weary, they'd drop, and then Aaron and Hur ran up and held his arms up. And when his arms were up, Joshua was winning in the valley, and they beat the tar out of the Amalekites. Well, after a battle like that, you got to have some thirsty soldiers. Did God shut the water off before the fight or after the fight? And if he kept it flowing until the battle was over, why shut it off when the battle's over? So 3 days later, they can be thirsty again? And how's God going to provide 3 days later? There was purpose in the river that was bitter and the tree that was felled in it to make a teaching point. One other time they got thirsty. Apparently the rock quit flowing for whatever number of days. Same rock's there. If it ain't the same rock, the type is broken. Because Moses was punished, God says, sanctify me in front of the people. Go speak to the rock. Let water come out of it. Moses was so mad at him for complaining, and you can feel a little sorry for Moses when you realize that this rock had probably supplied him all those years. And now, let it shut off for just a minute. I could use the illustration of Elijah who was sent to the brook in the famine, and it says, after a while the brook dried up. Then the word of the Lord said, go to Zarephath. And as I so often quote F.B. Meyer, he said God was teaching Elijah to trust the giver of the gifts rather than the gift. Here was a perfect case. The giver of the gifts had supplied him with water from that same rock and let it shut off for a day or two. And they're murmuring and complaining and wanting to go back to Egypt. When it was God that had opened the rock and supplied him all those years. Now God says to Moses, go out there and speak to the rock. Again, he was teaching a type. That Christ only had to die once. The type is discussed in prose in the book of Romans. Now, since Christ died and bought our salvation, we don't have to do what the Catholics tell you to do. Christ doesn't have to die every time we go to the Mass or the table of the Lord again. He died once. And we are not, the book of Romans says, to seek to ascend to heaven and bring him down, or descend into the depths and bring him up again. The word's already nigh you. It's in your mouth. Speak it forth. For with the heart man believeth, and with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. Again, God is teaching a type. He shut the water off so he could teach the principle. Moses was to go out and the spoken word would get it done. Speak to the rock. Moses, in his anger, screamed at him, you bunch of rebels, and he struck the rock. A second time. The type has no meaning at all unless it's the same rock. That's obvious. Because Moses was punished because the rock, which was a type of Christ, the same rock, was not to be smitten twice. If it was a different rock, it wasn't smitten twice. It had to be the same rock to be smitten twice. Moses lost the promised land. Because he interfered with God's type. That rock was carried by Joshua into the promised land. And when you read in Joshua 19 and subsequent chapters where the lots of the territories of the various tribes are given, you find the rocks measured again and again. I mean, the lots measured again and again. From a benchmark rock in the tribe of Ephraim, of the sons of Joseph who had the rock. Then again and again. And I might say, when Moses struck the rock the second time, again he didn't say, go out and speak to just any rock. Go speak to the rock. The well-known rock. The shepherd's stone. House of God. We now lay hands on the word of God to swear. This was the anointed house of God, accepted by God when he said, I'm the God of Bethel. The kings then, when they came along, stood on this pillar and were crowned. That rock went with Jeremiah to Ireland. That rock, when Fergus conquered Ireland from Scotland, he knew he could not get the allegiance of the Irish people unless he had the coronation stone. He took it to Scotland. When the Stuarts conquered, they knew they couldn't get the allegiance of the Scottish people or the Irish without the coronation stone, so they moved it to Westminster Abbey. It sits under the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey, an old rock of a substance not found in the British Isles, of a substance found in Palestine, an old rock with a crack in it. You have to ask yourself, is that crack the riven stone where it was smitten and the water poured out and the miracle of God? You go to Westminster Abbey today, the guides will take you there and point to the coronation chair and to the rock, and they'll call it Jacob's pillar. But they're as ignorant as a stump. They think it's a myth. They have no understanding that that rock is the rock on which the descendants of David and the descendants of Judah that had the promise of the crown or the scepter must stand to have their reign authorized and authenticated by God. Those with some scholarship knew during the war that Hitler was obsessed with religious relics. That's the basis behind the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Nazis determined to find the Ark of the Covenant. Hitler was obsessed with religious relics. He had an experience in Austria in front of the Spear of Longinus that his teenage friend, who subsequently became Winston Churchill's advisor on Hitler, this teenage friend, Churchill's advisor, described the event when Hitler first looked on the Spear of Longinus in the museum in Austria, the spear that allegedly pierced Christ's side, that had the legend attached to it that whomever possesses this spear will conquer the world or rule the world. He went into a shaking, contorted experience only analogous to descriptions of demon possession. Hitler was obsessed with religious relics. And the scholars in Britain knew when the war was touch and go that if Britain fell, more important than anything else, they must preserve that coronation stone that was under the coronation chair in full view in Westminster Abbey. They took it out of Westminster Abbey, hid it in a secret place, sent documents to Canada, sealed, to be opened when the war was over. And if Britain ever emerged victorious, which they did, these documents, sealed, kept in Canada, told where the stone was hidden. When the war was over, and the threat was gone, the stone was taken out of its hiding place, put back in Westminster Abbey. Men knew that that was a symbol, as our flag's a symbol, of the crown of England. Now, when Zedekiah, the last of the Davidic line, was ruling and Nebuchadnezzar came to conquer and carry the Jews into Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar thought that only a male heir could inherit. That was the case under Babylonian law. He therefore brought all the sons of Zedekiah out in front of Zedekiah and slew them. Then he punched out Zedekiah's eyes, thinking he had wiped out the Judah and the Davidic line, the promised line that God had said must reign over Israel somewhere as long as there's a sun in the heaven and a moon in the heaven. Nebuchadnezzar thought he had ended it, and he carried blinded Zedekiah in chains to die in Babylon. What he didn't know, one of those little enigmatic passages in Deuteronomy, the daughters of a tribe came to Moses and said, "What happens to the promises and the lots of our territory if all the male heirs die?" And Moses, under God's direction, made it a law that if all the male heirs died, then the female inherited with full rights. Nebuchadnezzar didn't know that. So he didn't kill Zedekiah's daughters. Jeremiah, the prophet, was their uncle. They became his ward, two of them. They carried in their veins the Judah line through Pharaohs, through David. And thus, with the male heirs gone, they inherited all the rights. Ezekiel prophesied over Zedekiah, and he said, "I will overturn, overturn, overturn," three times. And then overturn no more until he comes whose right it is to reign. Zedekiah was overturned. But the promise of the Davidic line was in the veins of the two daughters, They went as the ward of Jeremiah to Egypt. Tiatephai was one of them. Sir Flinders Petrie has dug at the site where they were, those who came from Palestine to Egypt. They all died in Egypt, except a little band with Jeremiah who returned back to Palestine with these daughters, then disappears from the biblical record. No death. He's promised by God not only that his life will be spared and he will die a natural death, but other promises that I'll get to as I go through these promises, including those that suggest he goes to a foreign land. And he shows up 5 years later, having married one of the daughters to the Milesian king of Spain, and then the other Milesian king of Spain, who had conquered the Tuatha De Danann, literally translated the tribe of Dan. In the Tuatha De Danann conquered the Firbolgs that were of African heritage in Ireland. The Tuatha De Danann were ruling, and the Milesian king of Spain came up and conquered them. It was that Milesian king that Jeremiah brought Tiatephai to wed, and the coronation stone. Now follow it. I will overturn three times, from Zedekiah to Ireland, from Ireland to Scotland, from Scotland to England. I will overturn three times and then overturn no more until he comes whose right it is to reign. Without troubling you with the lineage of the British kings that trace all the way back to Judah through Zara and Pharaoh, God's word of promise, accompanied by that coronation stone, has carried through history the record. I've said the British throne will be here when Jesus comes. It's one of the most amazing things of modern history. I mean, one of the princes can go down and cavort with a X-rated porno star in one of the Caribbean islands. Princess Di and Charles can become a scandal for years. And yet, this cynical American media press still salivate at the chance of being present where one of these British princes shows up. I watched them down here when Prince Charles came and when Prince Andrew came. I was a guest both times. Lord Cook, more than anyone else, was responsible for bringing them over. The press salivated. It's the most amazing thing in the world in this modern, cynical society that the British throne still exists. It will exist. God said, I'll overturn three times, from Zedekiah to Ireland to Scotland to Britain. Now we've got a dumb John Majors and a current British queen that's about to give that rock back to Scotland. That doesn't mean the crown will cease to exist. The Bible didn't say, I will send the rock three times and it will stay there. I'm just saying the rock was part of the pattern. The promise was three overthrows. From Zedekiah to Ireland to Scotland to the British crown. And that throne will exist until he comes, the greater son of David, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jeremiah, one of the greatest personalities of the Old Testament, took the daughter of the king that carried the lineage to Ireland. Where did the Irish king come from? Diodorus of Sicily says there were two exoduses out of Egypt. When Jacob died, Joseph was the absolute ruler, total tyrant ruler of Egypt. Second time that foreign rulers called shepherd kings or Hyksos ruled Egypt. They totally ruled Joseph and his brethren. Joseph was ruling when Jacob gave his blessings. When Joseph died, then the blessing of Jacob controlled. Jacob said, Judah gets the scepter. Joseph and his sons got the birthright. Judah gets the right to rule. So when it comes time to pick a successor to Joseph, they're going to go to the sons of Judah. Judah had two sons. That strange story in the Old Testament of Tamar, where two sons are born. Zarah is the firstborn. Pharaoh is the secondborn. When they go out of Egypt under Moses, there are no Zerahites. And when it comes time to pick a descendant of Judah as king, David is picked of Pharaoh, the secondborn of Judah, in that strange passage in Genesis of the sons of Tamar. Yet when Solomon, later a son of David, becomes king, the people comment that he has wisdom that can only be matched and has never been matched by anyone other than the kings, the Zerahites. Well, the Zerahites didn't even go out with Moses, the other brother, the older brother of Pharaoh. So where did they have a memory of the Zerahites ruling with wisdom that they could only compare Solomon's wisdom to? It's a foolish idea to think that the children of Israel, Jacob, were in bondage for 400 years in Egypt. They weren't. They ruled most of the time as foreign rulers. And when Joseph died, the Zerahites became the rulers, the oldest son of Judah. Judah got the scepter, his oldest son Zerah would take it. It wasn't until about 50 to 100 years maximum before the birth of Moses that the Pharaoh of Upper Egypt conquered Lower Egypt and threw the Hyksos out. The rulers fled by sea. The people remained as slaves. And it was those remainder people that were led out overland in the Exodus, and the only sons of Judah who were left were of the Pharaoh's line. Because when the Pharaoh of Upper Egypt conquered, the Zerahites fled. The sons of Zarah were Dardanus, Chalcol. You follow the lines of those sons. Diodorus of Sicily says there was an Exodus by sea, and then later the one by land. As always, the rulers flee when they're about to be defeated. The Zerahites fled. Dardanus founded Troy. Chalcol founded the city-states of Greece. The Milesian kings are Zarahites. That's where we get the name of the river Zaragoza. The Iberian Peninsula is from Iberu, which is Hebrew. Strangers who came to the land. The Milesian kings were sons of Judah through Zarah. One of them was ruling in Ireland, having conquered the Tuatha De Danann. Tuatha De Danann's tribe of Dan, people of Israel, and now we take the Pharaoh's line with Jeremiah, Tiatephi the daughter, wed her to the Zarah line, the high king of Ireland, and both lines of Judah come together, ruling over the Celtic people that are none other than the lost tribes, the Joseph people, the recipients of the birthright. And Scots means nomad, just as the Scythians were, again, the lost tribes on the Anatolian plateau. And God wove this fabric and brings through Jeremiah, the daughter of Zedekiah, of the Pharaoh's line, that David was the perpetual kingdom promise to David, was the perpetual kingdom promise given through his son Solomon. So the Pharaoh's line is now joined with Zarah. They're ruling over Celtic people, the tribe of Dan, goes to Scotland. Celtic people, the Scythians, goes to Britain. And it was a son of Dardanus through Priam that led the slave revolt that went back from Italy and led the slave revolt in Athens, received a fleet of ships, and the British chronicles trace his journey through the Mediterranean to the founding of London under its original name, which is New Troy. His name was Brutus, which is none other than covenant, and British is brute, covenant-ish man. British covenant man, and Brutus formed, again, the British Empire, or the British kings of London, the southern kingdom, and all these meshed together to have God weave a fabric of carrying out his promise of a son of Judah ruling over the recipients of the birthright promise, and the fabric is woven three times in overturn from Zedekiah to Ireland to Scotland to England. God gets his word done, is what I'm trying to teach. And if he can do it with the nations, he can sure do it with you. So I suggest you trust him and get back on the saddle of activity and quit laying around thinking about it. Start acting in faith. Now get on.